You know, I think it's
tape.
It's tape from VBS.
Okay. Yeah, long piece of tape.
Yep. VBS tape. Long after we're gone, there will be pieces of VBS still in the building. Yeah. Well, good morning. We're going to start a new series of lessons today and for the next 13 weeks. We are going to look at selections of poetical books. So if you're a poetry lover like me, this is the place to be. If you're not, we have alternatives. So, okay. Anyways, we're going to look at poetical books. The series of lessons has titles called The Value of Affliction, Job Appeals to God, The Righteous and the Ungodly, Light and Salvation, The Song of Praise, God's Knowledge of Man, The Voice of Wisdom, The Value of Wisdom, Fruits of Wisdom, Warnings and Admonitions, Remembering Our Creator, Sorrows of Captivity, Miseries of the Captivity. So what do you think poetical book selections is going to cover out of our Bible? Psalms and Proverbs. We're going to start in Job because a lot of it is in poetic form. When you look at it, you can open that in your Bible and you'll see that a lot of it is poetry. I think Lamentations will cover some of that. I don't know if we'll get into the Song of Solomon or not. Ecclesiastes?
I don't remember Ecclesiastes.
I think we skipped Song of Solomon for some reason. So, but it. Hmm? Yeah, be my week. I just pick stuff at random and just, here you go. That's always my luck. So anyways, we're going to be looking at some poetical book selections. I apparently have typos everywhere because this slide already has one. How many books are in our Bible? How many books does our Bible contain? 66. Are there people who have Bibles with more books than that?
Yeah.
Yeah, there are. So I think that's based on the Septuagint, which is 70 books, the LXX, as you'll see it in a lot of commentaries. But I think they've got more than four extra books, don't they?
Well, they have the Apocrypha.
Yeah, the Apocrypha. Yeah.
It's the Old Testament and the Apocrypha.
And the New Testament. And some of the Old Testament, I think they group some of those books, Ezra/Nehemiah. So, anyways, there are those who have more books to the Bible than us. How many human authors do we have in these books? Any guesses?
They always say about 40.
About 40, look at that. Look who may have read the notes. About 40, or over 40, however you go. And that's an answer that's usually thrown around, is about 40. Some of that stuff's hard to tell. You look at the Psalms, who wrote Psalms? Primarily David, but I think Solomon wrote some of the Psalms. And I think, who's the other guy? Lectham or something like that, I don't know. There's another guy that wrote some of the Psalms. So I think even some of the Proverbs were written by somebody else. And of course, there's weird things like, you take the book of Deuteronomy. We know Moses wrote Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, but he dies in Deuteronomy. Did he pre-write that part? Did Joshua write that? Did somebody else write it? Samuel? Doesn't Samuel die like halfway through 2 Samuel? So, you know, who finished these books? So about 40 is about as good as we're going to get. But anyways, can you name some Bible authors who would have had the best in education that the ancient world had to offer? Paul, you know, Paul's a great answer. Paul, the Jew of Jews, went through the Pharisee school with Gamaliel. If anybody could have had a prime education, it had been him. But he probably didn't get a full education, did he? He probably didn't. He only studied, do you think he studied just scripture, or do you think he studied things like astronomy and medicine and Oh, he knows it. Yeah, it's logic and reasoning about the scriptures and how it fits together and why and how it applies to the New Testament, which isn't even written yet. Yeah, he's highly educated in that aspect. How about somebody else? Luke, a doctor. Doctors have been educated, not to the extent they are today, but it's as much as they could have been at the time. Solomon educated himself when he had the fact he was the son of a king. You know, you're the son of a king, you're going to get the best of education. You're not going to, you're going to have special tutors in whatever they want to tutor you in. Yeah, God gave him that wisdom when he asked for it. So whatever he already had wasn't enough. So, Moses, again, a son of a king. He was treated as a son of Pharaoh. He was an adopted son of Pharaoh, but he would have had that education that Daniel. Yeah, Babylon took the best of the best out of Israel, and that's who he was, and he was trained and taught by the best. So these, some of these guys wrote books, and they had this great education. You look at authors we have today, some of those guys are high, some of these people, men and women, are highly educated and write tremendous stuff. I read a little bit of everything, and sometimes I like a little bit of everything, and sometimes I don't finish everything. but anyways, some of these things I've read some stuff which is pure literature. And you can see the education level. You can see how it applies to some amazing things. But sometimes that's not even really fun to read. But that's the same case with this. I just had Moses, Solomon, Daniel. But anyways, you got some guys that have a lot of education, but you also have some authors that have probably no education. Who are some Bible authors that would have had no education? Peter, John, fisherman, right? Was that James? Yeah, these guys are fishermen. How much education does it take to be a fisherman? Probably, you know, he learned it on the job, probably from a very young age. Dad took him out on a boat, taught him how to fish. How to mend everything, yeah. And these guys weren't seagoers. They didn't go across the Mediterranean or so. They were always in sight of land, so they probably didn't have to learn navigation or anything like that. Yeah, how to mend nets, how to watch for the birds, know where the fish are, watch the weather. But yeah, a lot of, like, yeah, not only mend nets, how to fix a boat, how to build a boat. That boat's going to wear out at some point. I don't know that it had used boat lots. No, David wasn't. He was the cookie boy at the David and Goliath battle. He just brought lunch to his brothers. Abraham, sheep herder, basically. Yeah. So these guys, not much education. But what binds them together, you can see it in 2 Timothy 3:16 through 17. All scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, equipped for every good work. So, what unites their writings, despite the fact that some are educated and some are not? What unites them? Right. And that, yeah, it's the Spirit. It all comes from God. It is written. Yeah. As long as it goes to there. That's a good point. That's what unites all the writing in our Bible. Along with different types of authors, we have different types of writings. And the notes that we have list several that I may or may not have ever come up with on my own. Narrative, legal code, poetry, wisdom literature, prophecy, parable, epistolary, I don't even know how to say that. Or propositional literature and apocalyptic literature. Right, you might want to put that stuff into real English because probably none of us here are English majors, right? No? Brent might have been. No, okay. None of us are English majors. Chuck and I are engineers. They made us take English so we can communicate with real people. Oh, really? English for engineers? Tech writing. Yes. Yep. Yeah, we had to. Remedial English. And at FIT, they have a language institute because it's a international university. They have kids from 100 different countries to go there. And you come there to learn English before you can move on into the other classes. One, because they're taught in English, but two, that's just how engineering works. But yeah. Anyways, John? Literal, non-literal. You're right. Some of it is, And that's a good point, because some things are absolutely, this is what it says and this is what it means. The scripture that's up there, there's no symbolism in that. It's not like, it's like God wrote it. No, God wrote it. So it's literal. But you take some things that are, they're symbolic. You have types and prototypes. You see stuff in the Old Testament that is like a prototype of Jesus in the New Testament. You have books like Revelation. How many times have you sat down and read Revelation? We don't even really talk about Revelation because of the fact. And some people think Revelation is purely literal, and some people think it's purely symbolic. And Chuck and I think, have agreed that it's probably a good mix of both. So what that mix is, but yeah, literal, non-literal, symbolic. All right, so what does narrative mean? Yeah, it tells a story. It tells a story. You can see a lot of historical. Yeah, Genesis is that way, is a good example of that. Genesis tells a story starting with creation. Was Moses at creation? No. God told him. He wasn't there for the Tower of Babel. He wasn't there for the flood. God told him. But he tells a story. You can go down the hallway and grab the smallest of kids, and they can probably tell you the story of the flood. Maybe not to the detail that's told here, but they know that story. But that's what narrative is. It's a story. You see it in books like Genesis, but you also see it in the Gospels, the story of Jesus Christ and his 3 years of ministry. He's taught four times from four different points of view, even. Yeah, you're right. And they claims I've read, when I've studied how we got our Bible, Moses is the first person ever to be recorded as writing anything. Now, I don't know if that's propaganda from the church or if that's true, but there's apparently in history, there's no one earlier than Moses who is recorded to have written anything. So things are probably written, but he's the first one recorded as writing something. Legal code. Where do we find a legal code in the Bible? Deuteronomy, Leviticus, Clayton's going towards the Ten Commandments, the Exodus 20, written on a rock. Right. Well, those. Have you ever tried to read some of that stuff? It's not terrible, but have you ever read the written laws of America? Try to understand that. The Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is pretty simple, but the main Constitution's not, typically. There are laws here in this town that are bizarre. I learned recently that it is illegal to shoot a BB gun or slingshot within the city limits. Really? Did you know that? It's illegal to use a slingshot within the city limits, Titusville. So, but the writing of it is really weird. There's also a law that says you can't be naked in Titusville. It does not exclude your own home. So, all you criminals that took a shower, you live in the county, there you go. And they wrote that law because of the nude beach, which is not in Titusville. Yeah, it's not anywhere near city limits, but that's why the law exists. Like, anyways, but if you read some of these laws, they're really crazy. There used to be a sign posted around town that said you couldn't consume alcohol on these premises or off of these premises, but it didn't have it. It's like, and I know Dixie Crossroads had that sign up. You can't. It's like they serve alcohol, but it was really weird. It said you couldn't. On or off. The Rippy March had on or off. And that's like, but it's not a dry county, dry town, but very complex a lot of times. Anyways, so poetry, we already kind of distinguished that kind of poetry that we're going to read. Yeah. And that's what a lot of law comes from, is liability. Just in case, or because something stupid happened one day, we now have a new rule. Wisdom literature. Proverbs, probably, Ecclesiastes. Yeah, and they're both a little bit of wisdom. prophecy. Yeah, Daniel. Daniel has prophecy. We got the minor and the major prophets. So a lot of, and some of those are a narrative as well as prophecy, but we have prophecy. But yeah, Isaiah's had a lot. Epistolary literature. Letters. Okay? There are letters. Like I said, sometimes words get in the way. They're letters. We see that a lot. Paul's letters to the Corinthians, Paul's letters to the Galatians, Paul's letters to Timothy. These are letters. Propositional literature, and a lot of that was, let me tell you how it should be. Let me give you a... That's probably about as good as I'm going to get on that one. But anyways, and that Paul does that a lot in his letters. Hey, this is what I see. This is some things that might help. Apocalyptic literature. Revelation, definitely. Daniel, partly. There's a little bit in Matthew 25. Is that the right chapter? I think it's 25. There's bits and pieces in other places. Apocalyptic. Basically, we think of the apocalypse as the end of time, okay? And this is things that point towards the end of time, and they are written in a special secret code. Would that make sense? It's a little symbolic. I wouldn't say secret code, but it's definitely symbolic because you don't get the full story. Right. And if you take Daniel, some of the stuff that's written in the apocalyptic language in there, some of it points towards the end times, but some of it is stuff that stacks up to that. And I know some of that kind of stuff, it's prophecy, but it's kind of that way too. And there's short and long prophecies. A lot of times short prophecies pointed towards a certain time, but long points towards the end of time. So, and I've heard this many times, apocalyptic mispronounced as apocryphal. Apocalyptic points towards the end of time. Apocryphal, like Chuck said, it points to these books that we don't count as the Bible, but it also points to something that's fake. So those sometimes are the wrong words to use. But anyways, we have different kinds of literature. Each style tends to communicate the truth in a unique manner. We can talk about narrative, gives a historic detail, emphasizes the perspective of the authors. Poetry is a language of emotion. So two engineers probably are gonna do a terrible job at teaching you guys about emotion, okay? I'll be honest with you, okay? If we had a couple social workers or poets themselves, okay? What can you tell me about poetry? What do you know about poetry? Who here likes to read poetry? Zero. You know, I got that question right there in a second. Can you name different types of poems in culture today? So it can be. A lot of times it is angry rap. A lot of times it is angry poetry. It's a poetry of some sort. Was it Kendrick Lamar got a Pulitzer for his? I don't know if he's fully rap. I'm not into Kendrick Lamar, but cultural significance. Limericks, yeah. Who wants a man? Yes. Okay. Limericks are it's AA. The rhyming scheme is AABBA. Yeah. So you could even. Limericks are a kind we see sometimes. If you're a friend of mine on Facebook, you know sometimes I'll have a week of bad poetry for one reason or another. I'll put a picture and some of my friends will throw in a bad poem or so for me. Limericks are. We'll have a limerick day. It's always a fun time. Especially the shop cats, I'll put pictures of them, and there's some crazy stories come out. So, okay, limericks, rap. Anything else that's poetry? Say again. No. Yeah, Emerson and I know those guys from I can't even name them. From the mid 1800s. Yeah, some of that stuff, it's serious poetry, and some of it is to look inside yourself. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's his point of view. Hi, Tiffany. We're talking about poetry. You came to the right spot. Right. And not all poetry rhymes. It's a timing thing. And the books of poetry we have in the Bible are terrible at that because they're not written in English. Okay? So the English is terrible in that aspect. It doesn't rhyme. It doesn't have any meter. Because if we had it in Hebrew, maybe it would come through. If you had it in Greek, it might come through. But we're in English. So you look at it, and if it wasn't written that way in the Bible, you'd just say, this is the most weird stuff I've ever read. It is. It's kind of just weird sometimes. So anyways. Other poems? We've got haiku. That's another kind of poem. If you're not familiar with haiku, sorry, you missed a great part of childhood. Was it 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables? Unless you're Japanese and it sounds not syllables, but. Oh, yeah. His stuff is. Yeah. Dr. Seuss's stuff is great poetry. Every year, Shakespeare, yeah, his sonnets. Sonnets are, 16 verses? Is that right? 16 verses? I don't know. Aren't you an English major?
Yes.
Yes. No answers from her, though. All right. I'll let my own inability to guess on it. But I've tried to write sonnets before, and there's multiple syllables. And we usually break out into Dr. Seuss in the VBS classroom in our Bible thing. Whatever lesson we have, we will always include Dr. Seuss in there in some form or fashion. I will break out into something like that, just to see Camille's eyes roll. But it will always, always have some Dr. Seuss to it, okay? I love his stuff. Did you know that The Cat in the Hat was written with the first 50 words you're supposed to learn how to read? So not only was it a poem, but that was his challenge, that he stuck with the first 50 words you learned to read. So we learned about rap, songs in general today. Not just today, but songs in general are poetry. As we get into some weird stuff, not weird stuff, some emotional type stuff, country music itself, the theme of gloom and doom and despair has always been a big part of country music. It wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the fact that that must have some kind of value. So, to read a poetic passage in the Bible, we must linger over the metaphors, the parallelism, the figures of speech, and all the other things that make poetry what it is. Don't forget that, Chuck. So if Chuck and I wear turtleneck sweaters and we snap our fingers while we read it, this is why. All right, this is where we linger. Man, that's it, isn't it? anyways, you got to use both your head and your heart to understand poetry, and that's really the key to it. You got to use your head. Yes. Oh yeah, that's a big problem when you read 1800s poetry. Like you say, Emerson and all those other people. Emily Dickinson, some of those people, you read some of that stuff and they use words. If you do crossword puzzles, you'll find those words in there. Ere, E-R-E, means what? Before. And you'll find that there. Will you ever use that word anywhere? No. So, anyway. Scrabble, that's it. Scrabble, crossword puzzles, no value otherwise. I like to use word sans because it goes in poetry. It's also my favorite font, which annoys everybody. So sans serif, without serif. I like to use word sans just because nobody uses that word. So today's passage is part of a speech by Job's friend. I got quotes around friend because you determine what friend means. These guys are his friends, but they give him some terrible, terrible advice. It's his friend Eliphaz. If you're not familiar with Job, most people are familiar with Job 1, where God says to Satan, Job's a righteous dude. And Satan goes, because you give him everything. So Satan is allowed to take his wealth and his family from him. And he still worships God. And Satan says, if you took away his health, God goes, try it. He takes away his health. That's usually what we know. It's 1 and 2, and then around towards the end of the Bible, into the book, you find that Job gets his stuff all back. He gets his life back tenfold or something like that. That's usually what we know of Job. We never really read the center. So And why? If you've ever read The Sinner, you know why. So today we'll talk about some of The Sinner, and next week we'll talk about The Sinner. So this is Eliphaz's response to Job's lament by arguing from the point of God's righteousness. So Eliphaz starts out, or part of his, Job 4, 6 through 7 and 17, let me just quote those. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Remember, who that was innocent ever perished, or where were the upright cut off? Can mortal man be in the right before God? Can a man be pure before his maker? So Eliphaz believed Job's suffering was deserved, because there was no way that Job was, fill in the blank, righteous, innocent. Yeah, you're not innocent. You think you're more righteous than God? You deserve this. That's where Eliphaz stands point. His standpoint is God is righteous, you're not. The suffering you have with your health and your wealth and your family is deserved. A quote from Daniel Estes, in his handbook on the wisdom books and Psalms. In reality, the assumption that innocence brings blessings while sin brings punishment, though valid in general terms, does not hold up to scrutiny in every specific case. Consequently, even though Eliphaz intends his words to encourage Job, they utterly fail to console him. That leads us into one of the most poorly named lessons that I've ever taught in this building. The name of this lesson is, what is the name of this lesson? The value of affliction, okay? This has nothing to do with the value of affliction. Because it's Eliphaz's words, and it is the most misdirected stuff. It's like quoting something for your own purposes. Anyways, I would have, in hindsight, named this something entirely different. That said, is there value in affliction? Is there value in the bad things that happen to you in life? Okay. Otherwise, does he train once he loses? You've got to be in the water. But I don't think he'd throw you in front of a shark to teach you how to swim. You got to swim fast. Yeah, that's true. It's not about how you want to be trained. Chuck? Yeah.
If you never try, then whether, you know, at a certain level, then you won't be able to withstand harsh trials.
Right.
You never will, because you haven't been trained, you haven't been strengthened. Because when you go through a trial and you come through it, you're strengthened.
Right. It's easier to see on the backside. Yeah. It's easier to see it afterwards. Like you say, today I'm going to start lifting weights. Yeah, hindsight is 20/20. Exactly it. I have a soccer team full of teenagers. They hate to practice. As a matter of fact, most of them don't even show up to practice anymore as teenagers. They know it all, okay? But you come to games, and the biggest problem we have is the fact that they don't operate as a team. They didn't learn how to do this kind of stuff. They didn't. The ones who put in the sweat equity, the ones who come out there and struggle through the hot day or a rainy day, and work hard, will shine on the game days. But the other ones, you'll see them. You can pick them out of who hasn't put in that time. In life, struggle is garbage. It's terrible. A few years ago, a guy on our softball team, a guy named Dan Kiesler, Dan had a brain tumor, and they had a surgery that he never woke up from. And he passed away. I think Dan was 39. Terrible thing for him, terrible thing for his wife. The guys on the team, although he didn't go to church here, Dan was recognized as a righteous guy. He was recognized as a leader on the team. The people in the league did that. A lot of the guys that played church league softball probably had never been in a church, or if they did, it was a strange church. Let me put it that way. Biker church, maybe? I don't know. But anyways, but Dan would... He wasn't a big guy, but he would stand to correct people and stuff. And he was a great guy. Like I say, he passed away. The whole league got together, and we had a memorial service for him. And I remember the prayer that Barry, I never remember Barry's last name. Anyways, he's one of the pastors at the Grove. He led the prayer, and he started out, and he said, "Death sucks." That's how he started a prayer. And Matt and I both looked at each other and said, "That is the weirdest way to start a prayer." But it actually said about everything that everybody had on their mind at the time. And so, but it's, you know, it's terrible. His wife has had to go on without him. They didn't have kids and stuff, but we went on and put his name and number on our jerseys, but there's affliction that just is affliction. So moving on to Job 5:17. "Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves. Therefore despise not the discipline of the Almighty." Although Eliphaz incorrectly applied his theological understanding of punishment to Job and wrongly implied Job was being punished for sin, he was correct to state that affliction can indeed be valuable. How is this applied today? And I guess really what I'm looking for is, how do we apply this verse? "Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves. Blessed is the one whom God corrects. Therefore despise not the discipline of God." Do you correct your own kids? Sometimes? Not as much anymore, and they're older, right? Yeah. Ask Tiffany, she's got 6. Do you ever correct them? Multiple times per minute. What happens if you don't? Chaos. Do you care about the child? Yeah. Yeah. It'd be so nice if you could just say, "Don't do that," and that just fixed it, right? That's all it takes. That's everything it takes in life. Just don't do that. But it doesn't. You're going to have to repeat that 6 times, 50 times, 1,000,000 times, right? Just don't do that. But if you didn't care, no big deal, okay? We can do that with people we don't care about. I get kids on the soccer team. Like I say, I got teenagers. Some of those kids will come. They want to play soccer. You can see it in their attitude. We'll work with them. They got no skills, and they got some of them even come with bad attitudes. We work with that, and they become better soccer players. Some of them, you can just write those kids off. You know, if I don't care about a kid, there's kids out in the league that are just that way. We got Bible classes that way. What do I do with kids who are just absolutely terrible? I got 2 choices, right? Teach them, tell mom not to bring them back. Which one's right? Sometimes a little bit of each. Hey, I couldn't bear it. There used to be a kid that his mom would drop him off once a month when she ran out of ADHD medicine. I'll tell you, that was bad. But yeah, you grin and bear it. And that's kind of how we do it mostly. We try to do what we can with what we got. You care, now improve. You'll have big, big improvements with that. Those we love, we try to correct. We try to get the best out of them. If God didn't love us, he wouldn't discipline us. Hebrews 12:7-8 says the same kind of thing. It's for our discipline. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, you are illegitimate children and not sons. We discipline our children because we love them. I have a son learning to drive. He is now eligible for a full-on driver's license. Okay. Let's hope. Let's hope. Out on the open road. You guys have been there. Not always the easiest thing. And he gets 2 sets of instructions from me and Camille. I tell him not to hit stop signs like his mom does. And I said, "You're supposed to stop at the stop signs." So, anyways, because I love him, we do this. If I didn't love you, I wouldn't feel the need to help you change. So what do you think verse 8 says about problems we see in the world today? If you're left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children, not sons. Could it be that some of the problems we see in the world, because people are treated like illegitimate kids, and never taken on as kids of their own. Yes. Yes. Who knows? Wildness, chaos. Yeah. You see it there. I've taken the boys from the boys I pick up with the Jesus van. They have become family to me. They're not illegitimate children. They're my kids. Okay. Yeah. I have established a special bond with one of Tiffany's daughters. We go to the salad bar at Sonny's together. That's our deal, okay? We go to the salad bar together. Do I let her just dip in everything and mix the spoons around? Maybe. She doesn't know. One day I took Rachel to Brown Hair with me, and she came back with a plate full of pudding and croutons. So I failed my job by letting her get just a plate of pudding and croutons. But Kathy does a really good job. But this is something. There's ways you can take them in as your family, and I know with teaching the Bible classes, that's kind of what we do, and it goes on beyond kids, it's adults. Psalm 119:67. Before I was afflicted, I went astray. Now I keep your word. It is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. Psalmist reflects on the afflictions of life. Once you're through it, you can look back on it. I mean, that was a tough time, but today, I am stronger. Okay. My own personal story, I come to the church. If you don't know the story, you get it. If you already know the story, you get it again. I was a PhD student, okay? You're working on a doctoral dissertation. You're on top of the world. I've done it all, right? Until you get a neurological disease and you can't do it, okay? But it's enough to knock me down to come to the church. And now I stand on the orange carpet, and I even get to go to the cool closed small group on every other Tuesday with my buddies, right? But in many ad hoc meetings, yes. But these are things that happen because of an affliction. I will guarantee you, you do not want to deal with something that happens inside your brain. You don't want to deal with something where you have a migraine for 3 to 4 years straight. I didn't at the time. But I can look back at it as something that happened, something good that came out of it, and made me stronger. My sister had cancer twice, including stage 4 cancer. She's lost organs. She's been through many surgeries. She's also one of the strongest individuals I know. So pick your own affliction. You've been through it. Some of you guys, I know your affliction, and I know you're stronger for fighting it and keep moving on. In the affliction, garbage. But afterwards, you can look back on it. But that's not the answer anybody wants to hear, okay? Nobody. Nobody wants to hear that this is temporary. Nobody wants to hear that you'll be stronger tomorrow. Nobody wants to hear God will bless you afterwards and he will protect you. Nobody wants to hear that this came on because of some sin that you had in your life, whether that's true or false. Because with Eliphaz, what he tells Job, we know it's not because of Job's sin, it's because of his righteousness. Eliphaz goes on, "Behold, blessed is the one who God reproves, therefore despise not the discipline of the Almighty, for he wounds, but he binds up. He shatters, but his hands heal." God's the one who hurts, he inflicts pain, but he's also the one who will strengthen. "He will deliver you from 6 troubles, and 7 no evil shall touch you." The God who corrects Job is also the God who will bless his children. I don't think that was the right answers, but anyway, it's close enough. And I really want you to think about it. To Job, this is probably not a comforting thing. Job just lost everything. This is not, although it might be meant to help him, meant to comfort him, I'm sure at the time, this is no pass. No thanks. What would have been a better way for Job's friends to comfort him? No, unfortunately, yeah. In my 18 years of being married, I've learned that myself. Camille says, "You don't need to fix my problems, just listen to my problems." Okay. So, and that's the case, because sometimes, I'm an engineer. I fix stuff. I simplify things. There's your answer. That's it. That's the answer. Well, I can't get there, Nobody wants to hear that. I don't want to hear it. I really don't want to hear it. So, no, nobody wants to hear that. And that's really the thing. Be a listener. Be a comforter. Love them like you always have. In famine, he will redeem your death, and in war from the power of the sword. Although these are general terms, God will protect us. He will protect his people. If you take his understanding, would someone ever die in a famine or a war? Would one of God's children ever die? And that's not the case. And I kind of got some things here. Do people die of starvation from famines in Africa? Didn't they deserve it because of their sins? What about those who are hurt or killed in a war? Those starving because of government oppression, like in Venezuela? Do those people deserve that? It's those starving because of parents' addictions here in America, right there on your street. That's about it. Right. It's a general thing, but not. We're not the judge. Leave it in God's hands. Drive-by shootings on the streets, innocent people die. What harm can the tongue do? It says, you shall be hidden from the lash of the tongue and shall not fear destruction when it comes. Really? Nobody's ever hurt me with words, right? That's one of the big wars I have with my soccer team right now. It's two girls who've been friends forever. Yeah. Does the victim deserve it because of their sins? Are there innocent people in prison due to false witness? Are there women and children verbally abused simply because they can be? Are kids bullied into suicide? These are proofs that it's not their sins that causes this affliction. Anyways, at destruction and famine you shall laugh and shall not fear the beasts of the earth. You shall be in league with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the field shall be at peace with you. Don't try to tempt gravity. Don't stand out in traffic. If you're riding your bike on the street in the dark and the Jesus van's coming, get out of the way, okay? You don't know how many kids I see wearing dark clothing, riding bikes in the middle of the street at night, or skateboards. As much as I like to think God protects you, you know, the laws of physics are there too. Job 5:22-23, at destruction and famine, same thing. Does God respond to the pleas for protection? He does. Don't lose sight of that. Although there are natural laws, he also responds to our pleas of protection. I need protection for a trip I'm making. I need a protection from this affliction I'm going through. He does respond to those kind of things. You shall know that your tent is at peace, and you shall inspect your fold and miss nothing. You shall know also that your offspring shall be many, and your descendants as grass of the earth. Job 5:24-25. Job didn't need to hear that right after losing his kids. How's that going to happen? How's that going to make him better? You shall come to your grave in ripe old age like a sheaf gathered up in its season. And we know that not everybody lives to full life. Eliphaz's stuff, although generally true, isn't necessarily comforting to Job. Like I say, the value of affliction, I don't know is a good title for this class at all. But there is value of affliction, but at the same time, sometimes it doesn't apply to every situation. So next week, Chuck's teaching, Job appeals to God in Job 13. So that's it. And my picture is a piece of this lantana. It grows in a crack in our driveway at the shop, okay? And what we basically have is a junkyard full of old metal and stuff. But it's beautiful little flowers that are basically weeds growing out of junk. In the face of affliction, you can still find beauty. So, huh? No, don't they? I never even tried. Yeah.